Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, and welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast. This is Peter Ott, and I'm here today with Charles H. Martin. He's the author of the book Lawyer Ball, The Courtroom Battle of the Orioles Against the Nationals and MLB for the Future of Baseball. This is an interesting book, and it's certainly an interesting topic of conversation, and I'm interested to hear what Mr. Martin has to say today. Charles H. Martin is an attorney with more than 20 years of experience practicing law for private, government, and corporate clients. He's taught as a full-time professor of contracts, sales law, and international law at U.S. and foreign law schools and universities. He graduated cum laude from Harvard College. He received his J.D. from the University of California, Bolt Hall School of Law, and his MBA from Columbia Business School. He's also the author of another book, Everyone's Guide to Electronic Contracts, and academic articles on contract law, sales law, and international law. So it's great to have you here today, Mr. Martin. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Okay, is there anything else you want to share with us about your background before we get started?
Yes, I am a fourth generation Washingtonian. When I was a child and I had a cold, I drank Coca-Cola syrup that my grandfather, who was a stadium vendor, brought in big jugs from Griffith Stadium where the Senators and Redskins played. I was told the syrup was good for colds.
Okay. Well, good. Sounds like you've got some background then in the sports world and certainly in the Washington world. So that's great. Well, let's get started. We're here to talk about your book, Lawyer Ball. Can you give us a brief summary of what this book is about? I think some people are familiar with it, but others might not have heard of this case.
Without being too technical, it's a lawsuit by the Orioles against MLB, Major League Baseball, and Washington Nationals in a New York trial court. The Orioles petitioned to vacate a 2014 arbitration award of a three-person panel of MLB owners. The award set the cable casting rights fees payments that an Orioles majority-owned cable sports channel called MASN or MASN would pay to the Orioles and the Nationals from 2012 to 2016. This MASN cable sports channel is the only one in the country that cable casts the baseball games of two teams, the Orioles and the Nationals. The panel awarded a total of $298 million to be paid for the 2012 to 2016 period to each team equally. Peter Angelos, who owns the Orioles, however, believes that his majority-owned cable channel, MASN, should pay each team only $170 million. That's a difference of $128 million for each team. Now, this situation of one team owning a cable sports channel that televises its own games and the games of a different team arose from the move of the Montreal Expos to Washington, D.C. That move was approved by a vote of 29-1 by the Major League Baseball owners, who equally owned a 1/30th share of the Montreal Expos at that time. The one who voted against the move was Peter Angelos, the owner of the Baltimore Orioles. Now, he didn't have any right under the Major League Constitution or their rules to stop the move the way some owners at least claim that they do now, like the owner of the San Francisco Giants claiming that they have a right to keep the Oakland A's out of San Jose. But he threatened to sue Major League Baseball anyway. And he's a class action lawyer who made a lot of money on various class action torts, asbestos, fen-phen, tobacco, etc. So Major League Baseball did not want to be sued by this class action lawyer, Peter Angelos. And to avoid that, they reached a settlement agreement, which was also what's called the television contract in the litigation, that created this cable sports channel that would be mostly owned by Angelos and would televise the games of both teams as a way to keep him happy, because he said 20%, 30% of my fans have been coming from Washington. This new team's going to take them away, and you can't do that to me. So this is how this cable sports channel was created. And even though MLB signed the agreement, it bound future owners of the Washington Nationals. It was a three-way agreement: the Orioles, MLB, and the new owners of the team once they sold it. So the rights fees, the Cablecast rights fees that the channel would pay were intentionally kept low the first 5 years. There were only $27 million for each team for each year from 2005 to 2011. After 2011, the two teams were supposed to negotiate a new set of rights fees for every future five-year period. But if they couldn't agree through negotiations, and they couldn't, the contract requires that the fees be set by a three-person panel of MLB owners that normally only evaluates the accuracy of cable sports channel revenues for Major League Baseball revenue-sharing purposes. It's called the Revenue Sharing Definitions Committee. Now, here's the interesting part for contracts lawyers like me. Whoever negotiated this contract understood that they were giving Angelos a big benefit up front by giving him majority ownership of this cable sports channel that would televise a quote-unquote rivals games. But the effect of this five-year reset of the rights fees is to rebalance the value of the ownership of the cable sports channel against the value of the ball club that gets paid the rights fees. And Peter Angelos, because he owns the vast majority of the shares of the cable channel and always will under this contract, would prefer that the rights fees be smaller than larger, because he does not have to share them equally with the Nationals. He gets a disproportionate benefit from owning the channel compared to receiving the rights fees payments from the channel.
Okay, hold on. So just to clarify, the rights fees in the contract are to be split equally among the two teams, but that equal sharing disproportionately benefits Angelos because of, he has all these other streams of income related to it that he doesn't have to share?
No, it disproportionately benefits him if the rights fees are kept low, because then the cable channel has a bigger profit, and that profit goes disproportionately to him. Like, he owns 80% plus, you know, maybe 90% at this point, but 80% plus of the cable channel. So he gets 80% plus of the profits of the cable channel, whereas if the cable channel pays out more in rights fees, he only gets 50% of those rights fees.
Okay, so that's the background of the case.
Yes, and you know, they've made all kinds of arguments. Lawyers for both sides argued before the arbitration panel comparisons, you know, the market comparisons. What are the Texas Rangers being paid for their rights fees, the Cleveland Indians, other teams, compared to what Washington's getting? And, you know, they had experts who, you know, media experts who compared the size of the markets. And I thought that the arbitration panel did a good job of analyzing with comparisons and, you know, what the accountants call pro forma financials, what revenues the cable channel is supposed to make, and how much of a profit margin cable sports channels that televise baseball games usually make. And they said, well, you know, based on all of this analysis, here are the numbers we came up with. And as you know, in arbitration, the arbitrator doesn't have to do a perfect job. They just need to do a reasonable job. And that decision by the arbitrator is rarely overturned by a court if they just do a reasonable job. But in this case, it was ultimately overturned by the trial judge, Justice Marks, in the New York trial court, not because he said the arbitrators did a unreasonable job in coming up with their numbers, but because he said that one law firm that does a lot of work for Major League Baseball, and I believe that Rob Manfred used to work for, called Proskauer Rose, represented everybody in that arbitration process, represented MLB, which was kind of the administrator of the process, represented the Nationals, and even represented the teams that were represented by the three owners on the arbitration panel in unrelated matters. And the Orioles early on objected to that. They said, hey, this is a conflict of interest. You know, they're representing everybody. And so the first thing that Proskauer Rose did was say, oh, well, we won't represent you anymore. So that takes care of that. Not surprisingly, that didn't make Peter Angelos happy. That wasn't satisfactory. So, but they didn't, you know, they said, hey, we don't want this. But MLB and their lawyers said, well, you know, the arbitrator can't really decide, you know, who the lawyers are for the parties. So we note your objection and we'll proceed. And they went through the process, took about 6 months. And in 2012, they came out with this decision that the Orioles, quote unquote, the cable channel owned by the Orioles, should be paying each team $128 million more than they want to pay them. Now, that's the point on which the trial judge ultimately threw out this arbitration award. He said, all of your arguments about how much money you should get, well, we don't second guess that. But I feel that this was so unfair for this Proskauer Rose firm to have their lawyers representing everybody in this arbitration except the Orioles made this whole process fundamentally unfair. And the Orioles said, great, now throw out the whole thing and tell them that we have to go to the AAA, the American Arbitration Association, because MLB has it in for us. You know, they won't give us the All-Star game and, you know, they won't listen to our arguments about this money. But the trial judge said, well, no, I can't do that because that's in your contract that you will go before this internal inside baseball arbitration panel. So just go back there, but just make sure that the Nationals have different lawyers. That's one of the big arguments that the Orioles are making on appeal, is that, oh, it's irrevocably tainted. They can't be fair to us, and so we have to go to AAA or somebody else who's not MLB to do a whole new arbitration. Because essentially, I think they understand that if they go back to MLB, it's not going to matter that the Nationals have different lawyers. The judge said, oh, the process was fine. I find nothing wrong with, you know, how they came up with their numbers. So they're going to use the same process and come up with the same numbers. You know, even people in Baltimore are saying, you know, this is just one big delaying job. You know, the longer Peter Angelos can go without paying extra money to the Nationals is the longer he can keep it in his pocket. And he's winning just by delaying.
So you mentioned that the trial judge, you know, tossed it out on these procedural grounds, and the Orioles have appealed. So is that where it currently stands? It's currently on appeal?
Well, it's a strange case. It's both on appeal, and the Nationals filed a motion with the trial judge to have him order Angelos to go back to the MLB arbitration panel. So it's both on appeal, and it's still in the trial court. And I've asked lawyers involved, you know, is this unusual? And they said, yes, this is unusual.
So we've got this interesting kind of split of where the case is right now. I guess looking forward, it seems like your projection is that the appellate court will kind of sustain the trial judge and, you know, say, well, it's in the contract, it needs to go back to MLB anyway. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, first, the trial judge, I mean, the Nationals are going to make the argument on appeal that the trial judge, you know, I think if only in the alternative, they'll make the argument that the trial judge was wrong about finding a procedural problem. There was no procedural problem. The trial judge, you know, cited fundamental unfairness, evident partiality, but he couldn't cite a similar case as precedent. So the Nationals, I think, will argue, at least in the alternative, that the arbitration award should never have been vacated in the first place and just let it stand. But if that doesn't hold up, then they'll argue, well, if you agree with the trial judge that there was a procedural error, we should go back to MLB. You shouldn't rewrite the contract to send it to AAA.
Right. And courts really respect these arbitration provisions. You know, if you say you want a particular arbitrator, courts are hesitant to give a different arbitrator, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you talk about this in your book. You call it, you know, a battle for the future of baseball. It certainly seems like a battle between the Orioles and the Nationals. You know, Major League Baseball is involved. Why do you think it's so important? And does it have effects for other teams or other parties?
I think so. First, because the internal business workings of Major League Baseball or any other major sports league have never been disclosed to the extent they've been in this lawsuit that I know of. Second, because voluntary business arbitration awards are rarely vacated by a court. As you probably know, the Supreme Court has cut back the right to class actions where contracts, consumer contracts, business contracts, say you have to go to arbitration. And basically, there are no class actions in arbitration. So this is a big issue. And if this holds up, plaintiffs' lawyers for consumers and other people who use class actions could say, well, you know, if it's fundamentally unfair for this billionaire you know, the way this arbitration went down, then you shouldn't be able to keep us out of class actions just because we have a contract that says you can go to arbitration, or we should be able to get this arbitration award overturned more easily than they have been overturned. And just in general, again, if it's only for baseball, that's for everybody. But if it's just for baseball fans, baseball owners have been pretty carefully selected to not be litigious. They don't usually give baseball franchises to litigious people, but you know, if they see Peter Angelos winning a lot of money, and it's a lot of money at stake, by taking MLB to court, I think other teams that are, you know, unhappy with MLB might say, well, you know, we'll take MLB to court. And if they could get an inside arbitration that's rarely overturned by any court overturned, then, you know, we'll start trying our luck. So in that sense, you know, the fans in San Jose who want the A's to come might argue about it, minor league baseball players. Now, those issues involve antitrust law, but antitrust law is only at the whim of Congress. They could change it in any majority vote. So if they start seeing, you know, facts come out in litigation that, well, you know, this is not really how businesses are supposed to be run in this country, you know, that you can do anything you want to drive your competitors out of business, they could change that exemption with any vote in Congress.
Okay, so this could be, you know, depending on the success of Mr. Angelos, this could be the starting point for even more litigation in sports, is what you're saying. And then and I think we've heard a lot about different legal cases in sports, whether it's football or baseball. There's certainly a lot of coverage of it right now, and so I'm sure the owners aren't looking forward to that, and unless they're the ones that can benefit from it. So, right. I guess that's kind of how litigation works. Is nobody wants it because it's costly and complicated, unless the benefit's big enough to yourself.
Sure, it's like nobody likes lawyers until you need a lawyer. Then you want to get the best one you can find.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, as we're kind of wrapping up here, I think it would be interesting to compare this against Deflategate. Everybody's heard about Deflategate. It's been, you know, in the news for the last year and a half. And there's also been coverage of this dispute. I've seen it, you know, certainly online, a little bit on, you know, ESPN or other sports channels. But I think we can agree the coverage has been nothing like Deflategate. And the implications, the real-world implications and the sports implications are big here, just like they are. Perhaps the real-world applications are much bigger than Deflategate. So why do you think there's been such a disparity in the coverage of these two cases?
Well, I'd say because thinking of football and baseball as television programs, football is a national television series, and the fans follow their teams closely for fewer than 20 games per season, you know, like 20 episodes. And so the teams and the players develop a national fan base that includes casual fans. Baseball, in contrast, could be called a regional television series. Fans watch usually only their own favorite team, which they follow for almost 200 games. So even casual football fans know who Tom Brady is because he's been the most successful player in football for over 10 years. But even fans who know a lot about their own baseball team might know little or nothing about some other baseball team, especially in a different league.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely a big part of it. And, you know, I think the kind of intrigue, you recognize the names, you know, everybody's, like you said, everybody's heard of Tom Brady. I'm not sure everybody's heard of Peter Angelos. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a sexier case, so to speak. But this one is certainly very important as well. So thanks for coming on to talk about it today. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Sure. When I was young, no one ever thought that professional athletes would become free agents. Now, no one thinks that Major League Baseball could exist without its antitrust exemption. But things change. And sometimes, after not changing for a long time, they change very quickly. I personally think that both the business of baseball and the game of baseball would be better off without this antitrust exemption.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, looking at baseball history in particular, there's lots of books written about baseball history, and that's one thing you see, kind of these prophets of doom saying, oh, if we have free agency, it'll destroy the sport. That's evidently not true. And time after time, oh, if these escalating salaries are going to destroy the sport. And then we see it's as profitable as ever. Baseball is, and now we talk about attendance and things like that, but still, economically, baseball, and particularly Major League Baseball, is very, very profitable, and so I, it'll be interesting to see where things go from here with Major League Baseball and with the legal landscape upon which the game operates.
It might give me a new book to write.
Okay, and where can people get this book?
On Amazon.
Okay. Well, great. Yeah, no, I mean, it's I've looked through it. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I encourage people to go out and read it. It's certainly an interesting case, and your writing style certainly makes you feel as if you're right there in it. There's a lot of dialogue and things like that. So it's a great book.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on the Sports Law Biz podcast today, and maybe when you write your next one, we can have you on again.
Look forward to it.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.